This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Burnout, The Emotional Experience of Political Defeat by Hannah Proctor. In the struggle for a better world, defeat can feel overwhelming at times, but it must be endured. In her new book, Hannah Proctor looks at how revolutionaries and activists of the past have kept a grip on hope. Burnout takes up a wide range of case studies, from despairing former communards exiled to a penal colony in the South Pacific, to exhausted Bolsheviks recuperating in sanatoria after the October Revolution, to a group of feminists padding a room with mattresses to scream about the patriarchy. Jettisoning self-help narratives and individualizing therapy talk, Proctor offers a different way forward, neither denial nor despair. Her cogent exploration of the ways militants have made sense of their own burnout demonstrates that it's possible to organize and mourn at once. Burnout, The Emotional Experience of Political Defeat by Hannah Proctor, out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is the seventh episode of Thawara, The Dig's rolling series on 20th century Arab politics with historian Abdel Razak Tikriti. Thawara is Arabic for revolution. It's a word that contains historical multitudes, diverse political radicalisms and revolts that have swept across Arab lands over the past century. Last episode, we left off discussing tightly braided events that catapulted Arab nationalism to the heights of mass politics. The Cold War intensified polarization across the Middle East. Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser scored a victory against Western imperialist powers as he mobilized the region against the Baghdad Pact Security Alliance. He also turned toward the communist bloc for aid, a defining act in the non-alignment movement's tightrope act he would forever be associated with. And, perhaps most significantly, he secured a political triumph out of the tripartite English-French-Israeli invasion over his nationalization of the Suez Canal in 1956. A victory that resulted in both state ownership of the canal and the stratospheric popularity of Nasser's formula for nationalist rule. But these victories begged responses. This installment of Thawara covers what happens next. It's a chronology of, one, U.S.-backed preventative counter-revolution, and then also, two, the unification of Syria and Egypt amid growing tensions within the anti-imperialist camp, tensions that would put Arab nationalists and communists at increasing odds with one another, a conflict that would become increasingly dangerous. In January 1957, U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower announced the Eisenhower Doctrine, which declared that the U.S. would militarily intervene to assist Middle Eastern countries threatened by communism. Already, Iraq, with Western backing, tried and failed to orchestrate a coup against a left-leaning, Egypt-aligned, and neutralist Syrian government during the Suez Crisis. In 1957, the CIA sought to orchestrate its own coup in Syria amidst a so-called Syrian crisis that hyperbolically declared that Soviet ties to the country meant that it was at risk of falling under communist domination. Meanwhile, the deepening regional divide pushed Egypt and Syria toward the pan-Arab nationalist dream of union. In February of 1958, the Syrian branch of the Ba'ath Party successfully drove Egypt and Syria into the merging of their countries into a single superstate under Nasser's leadership, the United Arab Republic. The Ba'ath were in part motivated by their fundamental unionist ideology, and in part by their desire to preempt the rise of the Syrian Communist Party. Union with Egypt meant, very clearly, that Nasser would ban all political parties in Syria, the same as he had done in Egypt. The communists protested in vain, but the Ba'athists pushed forward, naively believing that Nasser would be the muscle and the figurehead, while their party would provide the brains and the ideology. the United Arab Republic, as we'll discuss in future episodes, would fall apart after a 1961 coup in Syria led to that country's secession. And that deepening communist Ba'ath divide, as we will also discuss in future episodes, that divide will in Iraq descend into bloodier and more brutal conflict after that country's July Revolution of 1958. But we end this chapter in July 1958 in Lebanon, when Eisenhower landed U.S. Marines in the country in support of U.S.-aligned President Camille Chamoun. This implementation of the Eisenhower Doctrine, this first ever U.S. combat operation in the Middle East, it confirmed what was already made clear in the Suez Crisis. The U.S. was now the region's preeminent Western imperial hegemon. And then, I'll keep this brief. We put everything into making the dig, very much including Thawara. We ask just two things of you in return. First, support us at patreon.com/thedig. We can only make this podcast happen and do it with no paywall, so it's available to everyone everywhere to listen regardless of their ability to pay, because listeners like you, who can afford to support us and want to support us, decide to step up and do so. We have thank you gifts as well. That's patreon.com/thedig. There's a link in the show notes. Click it now. It means the world to us. Second, we need you to spread the word about The Dig, particularly this Thawara series. This is without a doubt The Dig's most ambitious project we've ever done. And you probably figured this out already. But we're doing this extremely detailed inquiry into Arab radicalism and the making of the modern Mashrik because it forms the historical backdrop to the unfolding genocide in Gaza and the struggle for Palestinian liberation that's remaking politics the world over. And we believe that this history that we're doing in this series, little known outside the Arab world, that it provides an essential resource for the left's renewed internationalist moment. Please spread the word about Thawara by word of mouth and on social media. We think it has a large audience that we haven't reached yet. Please help us find them. Thanks. And here's Abdelrazak Tikriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. One key thing that happens in Syria before we get to the Eisenhower Doctrine is that in 1956, amid the Suez Crisis, Iraq's interest in controlling Syria went from these half-hearted efforts to unite the countries under the Hashemite crown that we've been talking about that have been going on for years to active planning for a coup that, with U.S. and British support, sought to mobilize a variety of forces opposed to the Ba'ath and communists and to the anti-imperialist nationalist politics of Syria in general. We're talking about Syrian social nationalists, some Druze forces, Shishakli's circle. How did this coup plot come together? How did it so quickly fall apart? And what were the consequences for Syria and for the broader region?
Well, we should see this again in the longer trajectory. Iraq had been wanting to intervene in Syria for a long time under different banners. This had been a long-standing issue for the Iraqi government. They were concerned that Syria is out of the Western fold, and they had been doing regular visits to Syria, Iraqi officials, even after the overthrow of Shishakli, trying to encourage Syria to change its stance in relation to the PACs. As I mentioned, they did a lot of work with the Faris Khoury government, you know, and they tried to entangle it. But then what the progressive forces do is they remove the Faris Khoury government and they essentially install or create a new government, which is dominated by the figure of Khalid al-Azim, as I mentioned. Now, it has a figurehead, Al-Asali, who is not very strongly associated with any of the progressive forces at this stage. But, you know, he's a figurehead. But under that, you have a range of people that were allied with the progressive forces. Now, what happens with this specific coup attempt is that already there's growing suspicion amongst the progressive movements that something is being cooked, and they discover that you have these sketchy American agents roaming around town with connections to trying to stir the pot, and at the same time you have these strange Iraqi machinations going on. So they're able essentially to preempt that. Now the army itself is not set for a coup of this kind at this stage, Daniel, because it's no longer the army that had existed under Shishakli and before that under Zaim. This is an army that had produced a politicized officer class at this stage, and you had a variety of officers allied with a variety of movements. You mentioned the case of Maliki, although was not a Ba'athist. He, his brother was, Riyad was, and he was close to them. There's the case of Afif al-Bizri, who is a communist, and maybe not an official card-carrying member again, but everybody knows that he's close to that party. You have all these politicized figures, and there was no way that they were going to allow the hijacking of the Syrian experiment on the part of this Iraqi plot. So the coincidence between the internal political front, you have an active, basically, not, I wouldn't call it an alliance because it's not formally an alliance, but an understanding amongst the progressive forces, including the communists and the Ba'ath and other forces in the country, that they have a clear unified agenda. And they're grounded in government. They're there in parliament. They're there in the state. At the same time, you have in the army extensions of these movements. And that means that there could be some element of prevention of external pressure if it happens. And, these things even develop their relationship with Egypt later on, Daniel, because what's going on at this stage is it gets more than just a coup issue. We have the Turks intervening militarily in Syria as part of increasing the pressure. Once they start deciding that the situation had the internal situation or the internal attempt to hijack power had failed, what they do is all these rumors are being spread about Syria being taken over by the communists. And, and they're citing things like the appointment of Afif Bizri to the leadership of the army. When you're going around with this paranoid attitude and you're saying this is like Syria's falling to communism, Iraq cannot stand watching this happen, Turkey cannot stand watching this happen, we will save the whole region by intervening in Syria. They were creating this atmosphere that was not going to be met favorably inside Syria, and it was not going to be met favorably by Nasser either. So Syria at this stage, again, this is another reason why you have the importance of this a growing Syrian-Egyptian entanglement matters at this stage, because it allows for some breaking of the isolation that can be created through pressures like this that are, of course, at the end of the day, American pressures. Turkey amasses thousands of troops on the Syrian front in what was known as the Syria crisis that surrounded the situation. And Turkey is a strong state. This could have been really bad for Syria militarily, You have, however, also a geopolitical situation that relieves the pressure, because the Soviet Union is also now in the game. And the Soviets even threaten Turkey. Americans then, of course, start threatening the Soviet Union. If you attack Turkey, we'll attack you, all of these dimensions. But the Soviet Union plays also an important role in this because, and again, this is quite reflective of the new international environment that was prevailing from the mid-50s onwards in the Middle East. you could became increasingly clear to Western powers that that there was a new kid on the block in this regional equation, which and this new kid is a superpower. It's the Soviet Union. Their monopoly over the control of this region was gone. So it doesn't mean that they lost all their positions, but it meant that there were other options for gaining weapons and gaining aid, and that meant that their hold was weakened.
In 1957, the U.S. attempted its own coup in Syria, and to clarify, because there are a lot of coups in Syria in this series, to clarify, this comes after the failed Iraq-led coup attempt in Syria of 1956. And the U.S. coup is made against these extremely hysterical warnings that Syria was becoming a Soviet satellite and as Turkish troops massed menacingly along the border. And also as the U.S. made this huge arms airlift to Jordan. How did this American coup attempt come about during this so-called Syrian crisis of 1957? How did it take shape and how did it play out and ultimately fail?
So let's start with the background, Daniel. You have the Americans freaking out, essentially, because there were major changes going on in Syria. Some of these changes had nothing to do with entering the Soviet camp, as the Americans had imagined. However, the Americans decided to interpret them as such. So you had a set of development projects that took place with countries in the Soviet orbit. So, for example, there was an agreement with some Czech engineers to work on an oil refinery in Homs. There were also some signs that communist fellow travelers like Afif al-Bizri were being assigned major roles in the army, including the leadership of the army. And there was also a situation where there were agreements, weapons agreements being signed with the Soviet Union on the heel of the earlier Egyptian agreement that took place with Czechoslovakia in 1955. You had a visit to the Soviet Union from Syrian Defense Minister Khaled al-Azim, who basically arrived at a deal exchanging Syrian grains for weapons. So all of this was happening in 1957, and the U.S. was deciding that this situation meant that Syria was being taken over by communism. Now, in reality, of course, this was more like Syria heading towards neutralism and trying to exit from complete dependency on the Western camp, a Western camp that had not provided it with adequate weapons, with defense, a Western camp that had sided against its main enemy, the settler colonial state of Israel, a Western camp that was undermining all of its efforts to achieving complete independence. So in this context, in a Western camp that had initiated a range of military coups in Syria, let's not forget, it started the whole effort at undermining Syrian democracy by orchestrating the initial Hosni Zayn coup.
Back in 1949.
And multiple cases afterwards that we've discussed here involved Western intervention. So from the Syrian perspective, this had nothing to do with sliding into communism or anything like that. But of course, Eisenhower, who had just enunciated an insane idea, an insane doctrine, which is totally based on like the Red Scare, really, called the Eisenhower Doctrine.
This is a really key point here. President Eisenhower announced the Eisenhower Doctrine in January 1957, and it's a pivotal moment for rising U.S. imperial power in the region. This is in the wake of Suez and the intense conflicts over the Baghdad Pact. And then in 1958, the Eisenhower Doctrine is invoked in Lebanon. Eisenhower sends in U.S. Marines, which will discuss later on.
And he had enunciated this idea saying that if any Middle Eastern country were to request American assistance or aid, including military aid, to confront what he called the foreign military aggression, then the U.S. would step in. And by that, he meant communism.
And it's sort of a renovation of the Monroe Doctrine for the Middle East and for the Cold War era.
That's right, because a lot of these experiments in domination
in American domination had already been implemented in Latin America years before. We know that the U.S. always viewed Latin America as its backyard, and therefore had exerted its earliest imperialist experiments there and in places like the Philippines, of course, as well, and elsewhere. So now, they were extending their sphere of influence here in a sort of replacement of the British and French former role. What we were dealing with, therefore, is a situation where they had an incentive to intervene in these countries, but they did not want full-scale wars in them, because it was any intervention that would be too much could be dangerous. So under the Eisenhower Doctrine, the main intervention that took in military form was actually the landing of American troops in Beirut in Lebanon. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But the other form of intervention was to orchestrate coups. They'd already done it in Syria before, and they thought they could do it again. Now, the coups in the American case could either be orchestrated through local agents. In the case of Syria, there were some willing collaborators with them. At that stage, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party had shifted into a policy that legitimated working with the Americans at that stage. Of course, it did not continue along these lines. The SSNP now might even deny that it ever did that. But in that period in the 50s, of course, it was engaged. There were also some disgruntled other figures around in Syria that they were trying to coordinate an operation with that took on this anti-communist talk. And there was an adding of the pressure on Syria from the Baghdad Pact countries that had refused to cooperate with in entering that pact. In particular, Turkey was amassing significant troops at the time. Now, the main coordinator of this attempted coup in Syria was a figure, CIA agent under the name of Stone. And the fact of the matter is that it was such a badly planned coup, but also it was confronting a better organized now Syrian intelligence service under Abdelhamid al-Sarraj. Abdelhamid al-Sarraj was heading the Syrian intelligence agency, the second bureau, and who was responsible for counterintelligence operations at the time, managed to detect this. And on August 12, 1957, he was able to even arrest Stone, the main orchestrator of this operation, along with two other CIA agents and a host of Syrian accomplices. This also led to counter effects, because Bizri, who was rising up the army ranks and who the Americans feared was too close to the communists, now actually had to take action to remove any of those figures that he deemed close to the Americans. And he used the uncovering of this operation to actually make a move in the army. And this led him to actually consolidate his control of the army rather than reducing it. Then we have another situation where you had the Dulles and others freaking out in relation to these events. With this freak out, they were considering all sorts of options, including a military-style operation. Now, this did not eventually pan out because you had Cold War calculations preventing that. There was a fear that should they go in deeper, then they will get a Soviet response. The other dimension was that you had other voices in the Western camp cautioning against this action, including Britain, which was worried, again, that this would lead to negative results.
Ironic, given that Britain had just invaded Egypt just like roughly a year prior as part of the tripartite aggression.
Right. The problem that we were also confronted with in this context, where you had very clear Soviet messaging being sent out, and at the same time, considerable pressure being exerted on Syria from Turkey. Daniel, you had this situation where, okay, the coup plot might have been uncovered, but the situation was still tense. As I mentioned, the U.S. could have attacked. You had also Turkey still putting pressure on Syria's northern border. It had mobilized forces there. And there were causes for tension between the two countries. They still had the disputed dispute over Iskenderun, the Syrians never forgot that the French gave it to Turkey. And Turkey, of course, calls it now the province of Hatay. So there was a border conflict there. The Syrians were worried. What would they do if there's a big attack from Turkey? It's a stronger country. It's a country that is allied with the West, armed very well by the West. The one option would have been Soviet alignment. And that was not a scenario that was was supported by a lot of Syrian political forces. The Communist Party clearly would have liked to see that, but others did not, including the Ba'ath and other movements.
Not so long after the Syria crisis, Syria ceased to exist as an independent nation. And this is a really dramatic shift in domestic and regional politics. The 1958 unification of Egypt and Syria under Nasser's leadership in a new state called the United Arab Republic. How, after so many years of half-baked attempts to unify with Hashemite Iraq, does the Ba'ath Party and their allies in the army drive such a dramatic and fast-paced union with Nasser's Egypt? And what role, in particular, does the rivalry between the Ba'ath and the communists play here?
So the talk about unity with Egypt was not new. Talk about unity in general was not new in Syria. As we've seen throughout these episodes, there was a great deal of recognition in Syria since independence that the threats surrounding Syria mean that it needs a bigger form of regional cooperation for defense. And increasingly, there were many people that were saying that this requires full union with other Arab countries. So that was one issue that was very important to consider. Additionally, you had ideological parties that believed in Arab unity. So the Ba'ath is a very good example, but there are also other Arab nationalists that were very committed to this notion. The question was unity with who? So we've seen before that unity with the Iraqis was problematic. Unity with Jordan was problematic because these were monarchical regimes that were associated with the British. So that would have meant that both would have required changing the republican character of the country, but also leading to a return to the colonial fold in the only Arab country that had managed to fully exit it at that stage in that neighborhood. As Egypt exits the colonial fold, it becomes clear that that's the most likely country that they could cooperate with. Because Nasser, you should remember, had gotten the British troops out. He'd signed an agreement for their removal from Canal region in 54. Then he nationalized the Suez Canal in 56. He had already done the moves that we described earlier in 55 by getting Soviet weaponry and Soviet funding. He had demonstrated his commitment to non-alignment. He played a key role in Bandung and in shaping the Bandung policy and in propagating it in this part of the world. He was clearly supporting anti-colonial struggles in the Arab region, including the Algerian Revolution, which starts in 54, including other revolutions that we're going to talk about later on in much greater depth. So at this stage, this was a natural country to look for union with. And there were many discussions with Nasser about that in informal and formal ways that had been taking place at least since 55. So different ideas were floated. Nasser sometimes was enthusiastic, sometimes he was less enthusiastic. There were different issues on the table, Daniel. Some people favored the federal union. Others favored a unitary state. Those are very different forms of rule. A federal union would have meant that Syria would still exist as an entity of sorts, kind of like what you have in the United States, where you have a federal government, but you have a local state running a lot of local affairs. Now, the federal government is, of course, responsible for the defense and the foreign relations and other national matters. You had people proposing other formulas, confederalism, different types of what was called Wahda Indimajiyya, which is like, you know, the kind of unity that emerges two states into one. At the end, Nasser's view was clearly that he cannot come into this situation, run Syria in a way that was heavily decentralized. And in general, this was something that a lot of Syrians were willing to accept. Certainly, some in the Ba'ath were willing to accept. The view in the Ba'ath party at the time, and particularly the view of Michel Aflaq, was that Nasser could become the muscle, and the Ba'ath, and particularly Aflaq, could become the brains for this Arab liberation project that Aflaq and his comrades had long dreamed about.
Sort of a misreading of the balance of power between the Ba'ath and Nasser at the time, especially given that Nasser demands, as a condition of the union, the abolition of all political party life in Syria, the same as in Egypt, which means no more Ba'ath party. Also no more communists, but no more Ba'ath party too.
100%. You're absolutely right on this, Daniel. So there's, nevertheless, the Ba'ath agrees to this demand. So you have these negotiations taking place around the possibility of union. And they especially, by the way, to put this in context, they especially become very serious after the crises we've described in Syria. The American coup attempt, the Turkish mobilization of troops on the borders, this increasing Israeli intransigence, the passing of the Eisenhower Doctrine, all of this is creating a situation that is very tense. And at the same time, you have the Soviet Union coming in, indicating that it's willing to come and protect Syria against these threats. And that's alarming for Ba'athists and others who are not communists in Syria, because that means essentially that the country will turn communist. And in that scenario, of course, the Communist Party would prevail in Syrian politics. So
the Ba'ath are seeing it as either in this moment of crisis and danger that either Syria is going to run into Egypt's nationalist arms, which if the Ba'ath can pull off what Michel Aflaq wants, which is to become the brains of the superstate, great for the Ba'ath. But if Syria goes into Soviet arms for protection, that's the end of the road for the Ba'ath, and it will ensure communist supremacy in Syria.
Yes. So essentially, they're like, you either go the American route by not doing anything, you either go the Soviet route by appealing to the Soviets for help. And certainly the Soviets were very happy to indicate that they will support Syria in case of a Turkish aggression. They played a big role in preventing that, but still, it would have meant that they had increasing control over the country. And then the third option would have been unite with Egypt. And that way you can carry out a dream that was, you know, ideologically very appealing to the members of the Ba'ath Party, but also to the Arab masses as a whole. I mean, I'm telling you something, again, like an old friend and a brilliant, one of the key Palestinian historians of the past century, she's an incredible force, Bayan Nuehad al-Houd, who had joined the Ba'ath in the 50s. She was telling me that when they heard the news of the United Arab Republic established, it was like a dream. And she was like, when the United Arab Republic was created, it's like we were living in paradise. We grew up all our lives. We were born into a situation of disunity and oppression. And suddenly we see this thing emerging right after 1956 and Suez, right after of pushing the British and the French out. And at the time when the Algerian Revolution is raging, it was like we were living in paradise. All these emancipatory projects seem to be succeeding and on the rise. And it seemed that the revolutionary tide was unstoppable. So I think it's very important for our listeners to hear stories like that, because what people don't appreciate enough is how much these feelings and these attachments mattered to people at the time. So that's why the UAR was able to mobilize a huge amount of popular sympathy across the Arab world. I mean, Bayan, the person I referred to, was actually in Amman at the time. And for her, this was living the dream. You know, she was a school teacher in Jordan, had joined the Ba'ath Party. This was a phenomenon that was going in the 50s. I think we have to talk about it, by the way, around this time, that increasingly you had so many women also becoming politically active now. They were living the dream. They were like, unity is becoming a reality. So in that context, they were willing to sacrifice a party. They were like, yeah, go ahead. Let's liquidate the party. Let's disband all parties. The Ba'ath disbanded voluntarily. Now, the only problem was that it disbanded on the notion and on the assumption that they were going to be given key positions that were influential in government. And of course, they were given positions, but these positions were all not really effective. They were symbolic positions. So real power was concentrated in the hands of Nasser's men. And he kind of told them that was going to be the case. It's not like Nasser was tricking anybody. It's just, I think they didn't take him seriously enough when he was saying that. So, you know, he was very clear. He's like, you know, I think the Syrian army is too unstable. It's too ideological. I don't want ideological officers in the army. He was saying the Syrian political system is too unstable. That's how he thought of democratic elections and representations. You know, he thought, let's disband that. You know, Nasser was driven by a deep sense of providentialism. He really believed that he would carry the liberation vision forward. That's why, by the way, I always disagree with people that paint him as some power-hungry guy. You know, that wasn't the point for him. He really believed that he was there, put on this earth for a mission to engage in an Arab liberation project. Personal gain dimension was not the main driver. That's at least in my historical assessment. And I think there's a lot of evidence that indicates that. This man died quite poor, actually, relatively speaking. And his kids never made it rich. They had middle-class jobs. You know, this was not, his objective was not wealth and anything like that. However, he thought that he was going to deliver the region from the miseries of colonialism. He thought that actually these parties and democratic processes were just avenues for weakening the nation and weakening anti-colonial politics because they sowed the seeds of division instead of allowing people to focus on the mission ahead. Now, the Ba'ath had a different outlook, but nevertheless, they were willing to accept this position at that stage. And this was their honeymoon period with Nasser. It was not going to last very long.
How did the communist Ba'ath Alliance in Syria, which had held from, I guess, sometime in 1955 through sometime in 1957, more or less, how did it fall apart so spectacularly? And we keep coming back to communist nationalist and specifically communist Ba'ath relationships because the failure of those relationships to work, the fact that those relationships so often become so intensely conflictual and violent, this fact, historically, is probably the most brutally consequential internal contradiction of Arab anti-imperialist politics and fundamentally shapes the story we're telling during this series.
This story is very simple, Daniel, and very complicated at the same time. Because it's very complicated based on the events that took place. The simplicity lies in a very basic fact. One is you will always have inter-party competition, and that's driven both by personal reasons and by ideological reasons. So both are at play. Ideological reasons, we've elaborated them before in previous episodes. There are clear ideological differences between the Ba'ath and other Arab nationalists and the communists. The communists were insufficiently nationalist, and as far as the Ba'athists and Arab nationalists were concerned, and the Arab nationalists and the Ba'athists were insufficiently socialist as far as the communists were concerned. Ironically, both tendencies actually end up moving in the direction of each other. The communists become more interested in questions of Arab unity and more focused on Arab anti-colonial, national agendas by the end of the 1950s. And the Arab nationalists become increasingly socialist oriented by the end of the same period. So in a way, ideologically, they're coming closer. But you have another factor intervening, which is the geopolitical factor. If you are a communist, you will want alignment with the Soviet Union ultimately. And if you are a communist, you will have a different position on certain governments, including Nasser's government. And by the way, if you're a communist in Syria, you will not only read Nasser's government in the same way that the communists in Egypt are reading it, but you will be sympathetic to the communists in Egypt who are facing a crackdown by the Nasser's government. So it's a complicated story. You know, there's the geopolitical factor.
And if you're a Syrian communist, you do not want to abolish the Syrian Communist Party.
You don't want to abolish the Syrian Communist Party, and you certainly don't want to abolish it at a moment when it seemed that you might be getting closer and closer to the Soviet Union, which is your favorite state in the world. If Bayan Nuwayhid al-Hut and other Baathist cadres like her thought that the UAR is heaven on earth, the communists would have thought that establishing a socialist republic allied with the Soviet Union in this part of the world would have been heaven on earth for them. So these are important considerations to think about.
Before we get into the U.S. intervention, let's discuss the Lebanese politics of this period. And actually, before we discuss the Lebanese politics of the 50s, let's go a little more in depth into the longer history, because we haven't focused that much on Lebanon yet. So lay out that longer background of how Lebanon develops under French colonialism.
You have a difficult situation in Lebanon because the French had designed their mandate there to be able to create a state in the Middle East with a large Christian population in it, so, and preferably a Christian majority. Now, it is debatable whether they were ever able to achieve a Christian majority there, but at least they had a state with a substantial Christian percentage of the population there. That meant, of course, creating a state that's cut off from what had historically been considered to be most geographies as Bilad al-Sham. As we know, all the recent states that were created in this part of the world were manufactured entities. Some of them had historic roots. Others were basically byproducts of colonial machinations. In the case of Bilad al-Sham, the geographic construct was always much larger than what we ended up with on the map today, which split basically Bilad al-Sham, which is Greater Syria, into four different mandates during the mandate period. So you had Syria, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Palestine mandates established by the colonial powers. Now, in the case of Lebanon, it had a peculiar status because when the French wanted to create that mandate, for them to achieve a Christian majority, they would have needed to only have Mount Lebanon established. But then Mount Lebanon is the interior region. It has a Christian majority in it, but it does not have good arable land. It does not have access to ports. You know, the problem they were confronting is to have access to those areas, you need to incorporate areas with large Sunni and Orthodox Christian populations on the coast in the major cities, and of course, in the case of the Bekaa and the south, Shia communities. But it was felt that they needed to incorporate these because to make the state viable. Otherwise, I mean, it was already a very small state, but if it was just restricted to the mountain, it wouldn't have the necessary ingredients for any form of agricultural production or access to ports. So they ended up creating that situation. Now, initially, there was protests in all of those areas that were included in the Lebanon Mandate that did not have a Maronite Christian majority. Those areas did not want to be severed from Syria. So you already had a basis for future conflict based on that. You had another issue, which is, of course, Mount Lebanon itself had witnessed two civil wars in the past, in the 19th century, between its Maronite and Druze components. And of course, these sectarian civil wars, as very distinguished historian who you've hosted, Osama Maqdisi, as noted, were not a byproduct of primordial sectarianism. They were the result of conditions of the modern age, including the entry of European colonialism, including the changes in political power after the Muhammad Ali invasion of the 1830s. We can go into all of this some other time. I mean, it's a long Ottoman discussion. But the point is, you had a lot of unresolved issues emanating out of a sectarianization of the space over the course of the 19th century. And France played a huge role in that story, by the way, throughout the 19th century and also in the 20th century. But also, you had a very special set of conditions created after the French Mandate was set up. Now, the French, during the Mandate period, privileged, of course, the Christian Maronite elites. They had to take into consideration also the pressures coming from other communities, particularly the Sunni elites. So therefore, they created a system that could be described, and political scientists have often described it in those terms, as a consociational system, one in which elite leaderships of different sects would essentially meet together and make decisions on behalf of their communities and would have a form of power sharing.
On behalf of their communities, but really in favor of shared elite interests.
Exactly.
And it's this colonial process that increasingly over time turns what might otherwise be a class dynamic into sectarian conflict. And that sectarian dynamic is deeply, deeply consequential for Lebanon.
In the past, before the sectarianization of Lebanon, class was a much more important category than sect, certainly before the 1830s and 1840s. But then sect increasingly enters into the equation as a very significant political determinant. You know, it was always a social marker. I mean, religious belonging is important in always in any part of the world, including this one. However, the question of sect now becomes a way of also representing different class interests. And what you find is that new class interests also emerge out of this, because if you can make it to the top of your leadership of your sect, you can also access resources through that. You can access government contracts through that. You can access all sorts of advantages through that. And this becomes a big and long-standing problem in Lebanese politics and history that continues to this day. At the same time, it's very difficult to dislodge people from the leadership of their sect, because they're always threatening the members of their sect with the fact that there are other sects out there that are out there to get them. So they use inter-sect competition as an excuse to consolidate their positions within each sect.
What sort of state had Lebanon become after the end of formal French colonialism? And then, more specifically, what was going on in the 1950s and 1958 with these growing conflicts that had sectarian and also class dimensions and also involved a large and really heavily oppressed Palestinian refugee population? All of it a decade and a half before full-blown civil war.
So if you look at the way the government was organized, the president in Lebanon under the system that the French essentially created had to be a Maronite Christian. The prime minister had to be a Sunni Muslim. The speaker of the house had to be a Shia Muslim. Each sect was accorded a certain position within the governing order. And there are many smaller sects beyond the ones that we've mentioned. There's, of course, the Druze, there are the Armenians, there are the Protestants, there are countless sects there. There are Alawis in Lebanon. There's all sorts of communities there that exist. Now, the representation of each community depended on its size and political and economic power. And it also depended on how much the colonial authorities wanted to favor that community. Of course, the French created a situation where the Maronites came on top. They had to give some major concessions to the Sunni Muslims. And the initial Lebanese formula really was created by elites representing those two sects predominantly. There were other sects that were left out. It was clear that Shia'i Muslims in particular were underrepresented in government. They got a very raw deal initially. It was clear also that the army and the highest offices of the state were concentrated in Christian Maronite hands. That meant that you had a potentially combustive situation in that country. Additionally, you had a crisis of identity there, because part of what was going on in Lebanon from an early phenomenon, was that you had no national education per se initially. And the great Lebanese poet, who was also a well-known American author, Gibran Khalil Gibran, he had a very famous essay in Arabic saying that you have your Lebanon and I have mine. He was articulating an anti-sectarian vision. He was describing how each sect has its own schools, and these are funded by different foreign powers. The Russians had their schools, the French had their schools, the British had their schools. And all of these were educating people on different bases and were promoting different visions for the country. You had people that were very much pro-France, especially amongst Maronite Christian circles. And there were historic connections between France and the Maronite Church, because France was a Catholic power. And in the Ottoman period, it claimed the position of a protector of Catholics in the Middle East. And of course, the Maronites were a Catholic population. So that historic connection turns into a form of alignment or allegiance almost to France. And I'm talking here culturally as well as potentially politically. That was not shared by other communities. Sunni Muslims did not view themselves as culturally connected to France or politically. The same applies to other Muslim communities and groups. Certainly Orthodox Christians had less of a connection also with that particular orientation. So you had many different outlooks here. And again, we can't just reduce it to sect. Sometimes people are tempted to just reduce it to sect, Daniel. And I understand it, because sectarian actors end up shaping the history of the country disproportionately. But what is interesting also from the perspective of the left is that you had an emerging non-sectarian or even potentially anti-sectarian space taking shape through such parties as the Communist Party and as the SSNP, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party that we spoke about earlier, which had an actually anti-sectarian agenda.
There's also the Progressive Socialist Party led by a prominent Druze named Kamal Jumblatt.
Yes, and that becomes more complicated because Kamal Jumblatt, for example, advocates an anti-sectarian agenda eventually, definitely it becomes that. And he definitely creates a party that is bigger than his own sect. But sometimes other people view his activities with suspicion, suggesting that he was advocating a non-sectarian vision. However, he was really also a sectarian leader. So there are these question marks around that particular party. But yes, definitely, officially, it took a very anti-sectarian stance. And the Lebanese National Movement, which was led by Jumblatt, eventually played a key role in leading it, did advocate an anti-sectarian program, especially during the civil war and up to his assassination, most likely by Syria. So we have these different forces coalescing and emerging that are advocating something, an alternative to the system. Nevertheless, the system is there. And it's a system that is very rigid, it's very ossifying, it's very difficult to break out of. Can you imagine here in the United States, if people were expected to vote for Congress and the Senate on the basis of which church or denomination they belong to, or which religion they belong to? You know, if under that system, you know, you do like a survey and you decide, well, Protestants constitute 50%, therefore they'll get 50% of the seats. Catholics constitute 30%. I mean, by the way, I don't know what the numbers are, but, you know, but that would be the way to do it.
It doesn't produce a government with a lot of legitimacy, despite the democratic pretense. And neither does the disenfranchisement and severe oppression of Palestinian refugees.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, also what happens is then the most marginal groups, the smallest groups in society, get no say almost in government if you create that such a system. Because let's say, you know, in America, it would be like, what would happen to Jews and Muslims and Hindus who are much smaller than Christian communities in this? If you're not treating people as citizens and you're thinking of them as sectarian subjects or sectarianized subjects, you know, and you can call it citizenship, but it's not. Because by definition, citizenship has an element, has an equality inbuilt to it. Okay. Now, there are many nuances to the system. There are many complications. Some people say that it had elements of a working formula, and there's, you know, very detailed and nuanced discussion of this, again, that Sami Maqdisi, a previous guest of yours, has provided in his latest book, which I recommend our listeners check out, The Age of Coexistence. But I personally have always thought that it's a deeply corrupt and terrible system for any country in the world. And that's the general leftist view. You cannot create a system based on dividing citizens along sectarian lines and get anywhere.
Hi, this is Olufemi Otaiwo, and you're listening to The Dig. You can support the podcast at patreon.com.
The Dig is a podcast produced in conjunction with Jacobin Magazine. And yes, Jacobin is a print publication, not just a place for online commentary, but long-form, serious print journalism and socialist analysis. The magazine is released quarterly and runs at around 160 pages, filled with award-winning design and the ideas that movements need to thrive. You can join more than 70,000 Jacobin subscribers supporting this vital work for just $15 for your first year. This is a huge discount available to Dig listeners. $15 gets you an entire year of Jacobin in print and access to the magazine's very extensive archive. You can access this deal by going to bit.ly/digjacobin, all lowercase. That's bit.ly/digjacobin, all lowercase. There's a link in the show notes. How are all these things you're laying out building to a point of crisis in 58?
Daniel, in 58, we have a situation where the Lebanese president, who was quite close to the Americans, Kamil Chamoun, he wants to stay in power beyond the constitutional limits on his presidency. He thinks that if he makes his case to the Americans, that they will help. The way he deals with that is he makes a very vigorous case of, I need help. If I'm not in power, we're going to end up with communism, and so on and so forth. He's being helped, of course, by an ideologue who is quite right-wing and who was a well-known philosopher at the American University of Beirut. He was teaching philosophy there, Charles Malik. And Charles Malik was a very prominent figure in Lebanese politics, but was also very, very right-wing in orientation. We could say that he was actually partly a religious fanatic and Islamophobe, for sure. And there's very good research done by Dr. Nate George, who teaches at SOAS, University of London, around this. He's done fantastic work elaborating how some of these cold warriors in the region were also driven by Islamophobia and civilizational discourses and so on. He saw himself as, he even lamented the end of British French colonialism, actually. Somebody like that, you know, wanted the colonial order to continue because he saw it as a bulwark against Islam. So anyways, these figures are working very hard to portray the situation to the Americans as one that requires intervention against their local foes. Now, their local foes are basically representatives of other sects, had a different understanding of identity, and had different political ambitions as a result. And in particular, these figures were very much, by now, animated by Nasser and Nasserism. They had become very committed to the pan-Arab cause and pan-Arabist cause after the 1956 tripartite aggression against Egypt, which I don't think we've talked about it before, but the amount of solidarity it generated, the amount of one of my good friends in Lebanon, she was there at the time, she was a student leader, Ikram Sharara, and I interviewed her for the Palestinian Revolution website. She describes how she, as a young student, went to the Egyptian embassy demanding to be given weapons to go and fight in Port Said, help liberate Arab land from this aggression. So you had this enormous feeling across the country that also coincided with increasing alignment on the part of the Camille Chamoun government with the Western project. So you have two trends developing in the country. One that was pushing for an anti-imperialist, unified Arab world, identification with Syria, identification with Egypt, and another that was going in a very different direction and that saw the West actually as a defense against that. This intensifies after Syria and Egypt unite and establish the United Arab Republic. So you ended up with a situation where there was a serious crisis. And already you had student demonstrations. Already you had mobilizations across the country that were protesting Chamoun, that were protesting his attempts to have another term, or protesting his attempts to play with the constitution, that were protesting different events that were orchestrated by his supporters, including an assassination that took place against a well-known anti-Chamoun journalist, Naseeb al-Matni, was assassinated in May 58. And Naseeb al-Matni, by the way, was a Maronite, but he was a Nasserist, and he was very anti-Chamoun in his... which is why I'm telling you, there is this also anti-sectarian trend in space developing at this time, especially on the left. Now, in any case, you had very heavy-handed policy taken by Chamoun against protesters, and this had been taking place for quite a few months. They were killing protesters. They wounded a lot of protesters. And in 1957... during those episodes, they had created a rigged election, or what was seen as a rigged election, that produced a parliament that was pro Chamoun. And again, this was with U.S. help, including CIA help, by the way. So you had this rigged election. Chamoun and his forces had created with the help of the CIA. And that really enraged a lot of people. It created a situation that was deeply unstable in the country. What came to be known in leftist writings and in the writings of the different communities that were opposing this system, including the Druze and others, and, you know, mainly Muslim communities, viewed it as almost a revolt against the rule of Chamoun. And you had a lot of events taking place that included attacks on symbols of U.S. power and domination, including the burning down of the U.S. Information Service Library. So it was in this context that Chamoun requested officially the activation of the Eisenhower Doctrine, which meant that he was essentially asking for American troops to come to Lebanon.
And We won't get into this in too much depth now, and this is a challenge for the whole series because things are constantly happening simultaneously across the region. The Marines are landing at roughly the same time that free officers in Iraq are taking power in the July Revolution, something we'll get to in a lot more detail later on.
Yes, absolutely right. This is why sometimes it's difficult to disentangle what's going on, Daniel, and why it's impossible to tell one story at a time in this region. That's why in this series, in The Dig, we're touching upon so many different themes, sometimes simultaneously. Often we have to address them in both diachronic and synchronic ways because it's very complicated.
It's a very tough territory to design a map, a useful map for.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, any part of the world is always tough to write a good history for. But here, because we're dealing with an integrated space culturally, linguistically, but at the same time divided geographically into so many different states, and where there's so much external intervention. And I will keep reminding our listeners of something I mentioned in the first episodes, which is what Azmi Bshara called the Arab question. You know, if the 19th century was dominated by the Eastern question, what's to be done with the Ottoman Empire? The Arab question of the 20th century, what is to be done with the Arab territories that came about after the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire and the entry of Western colonialism into the region? That becomes a very big question because they're not given the chance to breathe and to achieve independence and genuine sovereignty to this day.
What role did the Palestinian population in Lebanon, the refugee population, play in the growing political conflict that led up to the U.S. intervention in 1958? We're going to talk in, I believe, the next episode quite a bit more about the development of Palestinian politics in the 1950s.
So let's talk first of all about how this demented sectarian system that we refer to, and I'm using this word purposefully, by the way, and I stand by it. This system, it was by default anti-refugee because what it did was it read Palestinian refugees on the basis of their sect. The minute they started arriving in Lebanon in 1948, you had, of course, enormous sympathy with them from all sects. Everybody was opposed to the fall of Palestine, including even some of the Maronite leaders that had been talking and other leaders that had been talking with the Zionist leaderships before. We know that Zionist leaderships had made outreach to some very prominent Lebanese figures, including leaders of the Jmayel family, which we'll talk about later on, including Camille Shamoun, including so many different figures that had been approached by the Zionists. However, as the Zionists themselves admitted, while these figures might sometimes have alliances with them out of convenience, none of them was actually Zionist. Nobody believed in Zionism in this part of the world. So you had this sympathy with Palestinians across the board. However, you also had hostility to the idea of Palestinian presence in Lebanon on the part of the Maronite elite, who viewed this Palestinian presence as changing the demographic character of the country, principally because the majority of the Palestinian refugees were Muslim. So you had this this difficult dilemma that was confronting the Lebanese political system at the time. It's a sectarian political system, and the minute you have the entry of Palestinian refugees, there's a change in the sectarian balance. What's the response? The response to Palestinian refugees, therefore, in Lebanon was to ensure that they would be insulated from political and economic life as much as possible. They were given zero political rights, of course, and they were also given not only zero economic rights, but also they were actually discriminated against by law.
And they did not have freedom of movement outside of the refugee camps at this point.
Yes. Refugee camps were horrible places and they continue to be. And I want to make a small comparison, Daniel, and it's something that's very interesting to note. Most of the refugee camps that became Palestinian refugee camps, or many of them at least, were former Armenian refugee camps. And the Armenian refugees, when they had arrived to Lebanon, unlike the Palestinian refugees, they were actually given access to Lebanese citizenship. They became part of the Lebanese political community and economic community, and they were absorbed into Lebanese life.
Armenians are Christians, mostly.
Entirely, in the case of the Armenians in Lebanon. So, had they not been Christians, it might have looked very different. If these were Circassian Muslims, let's say, that arrived at a certain moment after the French had established their mandate, we don't know how it would have looked like. But certainly when it came to the Palestinians, it was treated as a menace, as a threat to the delicate balance that was established by the sectarian format. And what helped with this was that the ideology that was invented by the French, the ideology of identity that was invented by the French and that was propagated through their schools, encouraged the notion that somehow Lebanese were racially, and certainly Lebanese Christians, were racially and ethnically different from Palestinians, Syrians, and indeed all Arabs around them. Now, for any serious historian, this is a ridiculous proposition because we know that that's not the case. But those people invented, talking here primarily, French colonial officials and the local figures that decided to buy into or to drink the Kool-Aid that they were providing, they convinced a lot of people that Lebanese are Phoenicians, in particular Lebanese Christians are Phoenicians. Sometimes they have another version saying they're descendants of Assyrians and other communities that had predated the Arab invasion. You had all sorts of different claims floating around. Of course, by the way, FYI, from ancient historians will tell you that the attempt to differentiate Phoenicians from Canaanites are a bit sketchy, to say the least. Phoenicians is a word that was used by the Greeks to refer to Canaanite groups that were Canaanite coastal groups, but which means that, you know, the whole Syrian coast included populations of the sort. And good luck trying to disentangle what's Lebanese in this formula and what's Palestinian and what's Syrian. It's a very weird situation, Daniel, because you compare Lebanon to Palestine, then the dances are the same, they're very similar. They both have the dabke. The food is very, very similar. The music is very similar. The language, the accents in the north of Palestine, the south of Lebanon are so close. There's so much in common. There's actually barely any difference. It's so minimal. And the same can be said for other regions that are connected to Syria. So all these racial theories, of course, are bogus. We know that to begin with. However, if they're taught enough in schools and if they're propagated long enough and if they're repeated over and over again, people start buying into them. So Palestinians were subjected to that system. And that those kind of theories helped with that. Now, they were denied employment in many, many sectors. There's a list of over 70 professions that Palestinians are not allowed to work in. And this, of course, was in contrast to what was going on in a place like Syria, where by law, and we mentioned when this happened in 1949, and through the efforts of progressive figures in the government, like Akram Hourani and like Michel Aflaq, we had changes in the legal system that allowed Palestinians to work in all government offices. And later on, by 1955, we have even, and this is something we'll talk about later on, the inclusion of Palestinians in the military as part of the military service. So in Syria, they created a system that allowed for Palestinians to keep their identity so as to preserve their right of return while having civil rights and having equal economic rights and in many ways some political rights, because Palestinians were participating in many different aspects of Syrian politics at the time. Lebanon was a different story. The amount of discrimination was unbelievable. The amount of control that the Deuxième Bureau had, the second bureau, which is basically the intelligence service in Lebanon, had over the refugee camps. It was a reign of terror. They would not allow people to build. They would discriminate against people in every element of life. And remember, we're dealing here with a population that had already been brutalized, already been dispossessed, already been uprooted. This reality did not necessarily express the popular feeling in Lebanon at the time, but it certainly was the official political position. So you had many people who were sympathetic in Lebanon to the Palestinian plight, but unfortunately the government acted against Palestinian refugees and continues to act against them to this day. Now, they were using the argument that they were protecting the right of return of these refugees, and that by somehow denying them these rights or refusing their resettlement, that's actually a bogus claim. Because Palestinian refugees themselves did not want to be resettled. They were insisting, saying, we want to go back home. But that does not mean that we can't live an ordinary life while we're in exile.
Did that dynamic of sectarian, motivated, anti-Palestinian oppression, did that contribute to the political crisis in 1958?
That was a part of the political crisis. But I would say that it was not yet the dominant theme in that political crisis. So we had generalized fears about the presence of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, and there was a fear that these refugees were becoming more and more active in leftist movements, in other radical bodies. And certainly, there's no question about it, Palestinian refugees did play a big role in the creation of, or at least the expansion of, leftist and progressive circles and revolutionary circles across the region, including in Lebanon. So that's definitely a theme that was in existence. Now, I should add here an important note, which is that we should never forget the class dimension also here, even when it comes to the refugee question. Palestinians who belonged to the upper classes and were able to bring capital, and there was a very large number of them. By the way, part of the reason why Beirut was flourishing in the 50s was that you had all this influx of capital from Palestine to it. You know, the big Mediterranean port in the 40s and 30s was Haifa. It was bigger than Beirut. It was like really major. All this capital in Palestine from Yaffa and Haifa was sent to Beirut in the aftermath of the Nakba. A lot of trade that had gone through Haifa and other Palestinian ports was diverted to Beirut. And Lebanon was, at the time of the 1950s, presenting itself essentially as the place to conduct business in the Middle East, as the kind of place where East meets West, where Western companies could operate to engage the rest of the region.
We've discussed all the context. Then we have the U.S. Marines landing at Lebanese President Shamoun's invitation in 1958, with the July Revolution in Iraq happening in the background. How does this operation unfold, and what are its consequences?
On the military front, the operation was pretty large. You had the launch of a military operation called Operation Blue Bat, and it was authorized on the 15th of July, 1958. This witnessed the Eisenhower essentially saying, I'm serious about my doctrine. Now, there was no actual military threat to deal with, per se. This is the irony about this operation. This was actually more about dealing with internal opponents rather than external ones. It's not like Nasser was saying, I'm going to invade from the UAR. It's not like the Soviet Union was saying, I'm going to invade Lebanon. So the whole thing was bogus to begin with. The purpose was to make a show of force and demonstrate that they're supporting Shamoun. They were going to do that by taking control of the main essential organs of transport in the country, the airport, the port. They were going to show Marines in the country to demonstrate that America is serious there with all of its weaponry and all of its naval divisions. And essentially, there were like 14,000 troops involved. It's huge. And there were like all these naval forces, the whole of the United States Sixth Fleet. They had aircraft carriers. They had all of these different operational command centers involved. They had land forces, Second Provisional Marine Force, the United States Army Task Force 201, all these were involved here. What that meant was that there was this big message sent out. However, that created an additional pressure. You know, it, rather than lowering the temperature, it actually antagonized people more. At the end of the day, the solution to the crisis was not military. It ended up being political. You know, Shimon was not going to be president. He was not able to secure another term. A compromise was orchestrated, and the Americans helped with this compromise, but also Nasser played a big role in it. So the compromise that took place was the election of General Fuad Shihab, who was a military leader, of course, also a Maronite military leader, as the president in Lebanon. And that's somebody that was essentially a compromise candidate. His election witnessed the introduction of an era that's referred to in Lebanese history as Shihabism. He sought to somehow create a new type of Lebanese state. Actually, many people say that the first real Lebanese state started under him. He started creating state institutions that do not necessarily serve one particular sect, that are open to all sects. They represent Lebanon as a whole. So that was a big part of this project. It was a kind of way of achieving some level of reconciliation, because effectively what you had in the closing months of 57 and the year, the months of 58, was effectively the country having a mini civil war, really. All these clashes and counter-clashes, all these clampdowns. This was the only solution to it, was to come up with a formula like this. Now, of course, this was not a satisfactory finale to the situation. It was not even a final act in the Lebanese saga, because it did not deal with the root causes of the problem, which is that the whole sectarian system was still in operation. So even if you were to expand the state, you still had to deal with the fact that the politics surrounding the state were sectarian. So you're not going to solve sectarianism by expanding bureaucracies and creating services and maybe even promoting a sense of national identity. It's not enough. You needed to end the sectarianization of politics and the process of selecting politicians on a sectarian basis. The other thing that was not actually dealt with was the Palestinian question. Because rather than relaxing the oppression of Palestinians, Fuad Shihab actually intensified it. He was very much of a military mindset, and he really was cracking down and adding pressure to Palestinian communities in significant ways. So this is the Lebanese side of the equation. On the regional side, 58 is also important, and the U.S. Marine landing was also important because it created tension regionally. It sent a signal that heightened the temperature at a time when the region was already very hot. It added fuel to the fire. It did not need to happen that way. All those that were anti-colonial in outlook saw this as one more episode in the American attempt to dominate the region, which, of course, was the American project at the time.
That was the seventh episode of Thawara, the Dig's series on 20th century Arab politics with Abdelrazak Tikriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that revolutions are the locomotives of history, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis. Our associate producer is Jackson Roach. Music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our communications coordinator is Sylvia Atwood. Our senior advisors are Theo Rio Francos and Ben Maybe. Check out our vast archives and newsletters at thedigradio.com. Follow us on Twitter and also on Instagram at The Dig Radio, and find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to this podcast. If it's on iTunes or Spotify or wherever, please rate and review us. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. But what really does that is you telling other people to check out the pod, particularly this series, Thawara. Please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com and make a monthly or annual contribution to keep this operation up and running strong. Even a few bucks is huge.